Life has a tricky way of creating conditions in which people sometimes grow apart. And people who are close can grow apart by distance, by time. And in Parshas Vayeshev, Miketz, Vayigash, Vayichi, we see people who have grown apart not just by the space of time and land and geography, but by hurt feelings, by differing narratives. Yosef's life over the last 20-plus years has been so different from the life of his brother, but it's not just a difference that can be metered or measured in dress or in environment, but emotionally he was so hurt and so betrayed. And he cauterized that part of his life, and they cauterized that part of their life also because they had to live with the guilt of, presumably in their minds, murdering their brother, because as far as they were concerned, they had every reason to believe that he had been taken as a slave, and who know what fate had befallen him. So they weren't just separated by distance. There was an emotional canyon, an emotional chasm between them. They weren't thinking of each other. They weren't living together. And all of a sudden, in Parshas Vayigash, Yosef reveals himself to his brothers, Ani Yosef, and it is a moment of epiphany. Chazal likened this in some small measure to the moment of epiphany, the moment of revelation which each person will undergo when you ascend to Shemayim and face your own personal truth, not the truth about someone else, but the truth about yourself, self-truth, which we avoid assiduously, desperately. No one can live with the absolute truth of whom they are. We all have to lie to ourselves elaborately to create myths about what lives we are leading. And hopefully those are small myths. We're more or less in touch with our actions. We don't lie to ourselves. There's a great American author, an educator named Eric Hoffer, who once wrote that we lie loudest when we lie to ourselves. And it's the honesty of self. Sometimes we demand honesty from other people. We have very finely tuned eyes for hypocrites, and we feel contempt and disdain towards those who strike us as hypocritical. We don't sense our own inner hypocrisy, and sometimes we have to learn to be a little bit more welcoming and tolerant of other people's imperfection, because we're able to sense that that's just a reflection of our own imperfection, and what really lives that perfect, true, honest, candid life. So when we come to Shemayim and we face that honesty, because the light of HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows no distortion, at that point, we won't be able to answer Hashem. The Vilna Gaon has a very famous statement that people will forget their names when they come to final mishpat, which is why some people have a minhag to say a pasuk that begins with the first letter of their first name and ends with the last letter of their first name, so remember their name when final justice comes. So Yosef still has to convince. He has to convince them that he is who he says he is. And it's not just practical, will they believe him, but it's turning back to common experiences of their past that bonded them, that outlast the ravages of time, that outlast the emotional severing which has undoubtedly taken place. And when Yosef's convincing them, he isn't merely trying to convince them so that when they take a poll, is this really your brother, they'll say yes. It's not a binary moment. Will they say yes or no? Will they accept him as who he is, or they'll deny and perhaps take him for an imposter? There's an emotional recovery process. He's trying to reconnect. He's trying to rebuild bonds that have withered away under the force of betrayal, under the force of hostility, under the force of isolation and bereavement. He has to rebuild a nuclear family. He has to rebuild brotherhood where it didn't exist. And he references part of their joint past that's so powerful that it just takes them right back to where they were 20-plus years ago. He's explaining the conditions of his being in Mitzrayim, and he's justifying it or contextualizing it in a larger frame of Siyata Dishmaya, Hashem puts me here and placed me here for a purpose. And that's always a proportion restorer whenever we see our lives not in the myopic details of our day-to-day. Sometimes that can be very, very narrowing and very parochial. What lives do we lead, and who has hurt us, and whom have we hurt? But there's a larger saga, a larger divine process that we're part of, and we have roles. And Yosef clearly senses that role and conveys that sensitivity to his brothers, and that allows him to contextualize and lessen the brunt of their crime. That despite your own machinations and calculations and treachery, I ended up in a state where Hashem needed me to be, in Mitzrayim, feeding the world, propelling Jewish history. But he ends with a very strange reference. Again, he's trying to convince his brothers. This is in Perek Memhei. This is Pasuk Yud Beis. V'hinei Echem Ra'os, you see me. V'hinei Achi Binyamin, and my brother Binyamin sees me. And he maybe IDs me in ways you can't. We share the exact same genome, same father, same mother, unlike the other brothers. So our voices are similar, our behavior is similar. And then he concludes the Pasuk, Kifi HaMedaber Aleichem. Listen to me speaking to you. And the simple reading of listen to me speaking to you is, as I said before, there's a subtext that can only be conveyed vocally, auditory, listening to someone's voice, first-person account, first-person intimate interaction. This isn't something you need to prove empirically. You've been in a room with me, you know my behavior, you know my gestures, you know my way of talking and the actual sound of my voice, and let that percolate through your soul, through your neshama, and convince you of truths which the mind and the eye and pure cold logic. Maybe this reality seems illogical to you, but you're sharing the same room with me and we were once brothers. But there's something deeper than that, according to Chazal. Yosef spoke to them for the first time in Hebrew, in Lashon HaKodesh. And throughout this saga, we've witnessed part of the threat which they felt was that this entire saga was being conducted in a foreign language. There was a miturgamon, and Rashi fills us in, this was Menashe, but Yosef's statements were spoken in Egyptian, and certainly the statements of Yosef's assistants. And you're always uncomfortable when you're forced to speak and listen to languages which are foreign to you. You always feel insecure because the people around you are speaking with such confidence and such conversance and such aptitude, and you have to cough out your words and you have to translate. Even if you know the language, you're still forced. That's why immigrants always feel lesser. Immigrants always feel like they have to catch up with the society because the simple interactions of day-to-day experience of speaking to each other, listening to each other, are more challenging for those that don't have that natural familiarity with language, as we would call it, a mama lashon. So the added threat, aside from the fact that they were twice apprehended, they were caught stealing the money, at least in their minds they thought they were caught stealing, and then stealing Yosef's cup and imprisoned with Shimon and accused of being spies, is that this whole negotiation was conducted in Egyption. And that added a level of terror and of fear and of discomfort to the ongoing antagonism and ongoing face-off between the brothers and this viceroy of Egypt. And now for the first time, Yosef relieves that stress, and he speaks in Hebrew, and there must have been a release for them to hear their native tongue being spoken. But more than the psychological release which they felt hearing Hebrew, Yosef is convincing them and taking them back to that place 23, 24 years ago where they all spoke Hebrew and they all lived together in Shechem or in Hebron, wherever they were. And it's the power of language to bond people. It's the power of language to bridge the memories or the years and return you to a prior state. Language is a very, very powerful tool. It's a beautiful medrash, Parshas Veschanan, in which Moshe is pleading his case to enter the land of Eretz Yisrael, and he davens 500 tefillos, and none of them are successful, and his final tefillah is more or less the following approach. He says, I may not deserve to enter the land of Israel on my own, but I've been carrying Yosef's bones, and those bones will be buried in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore let me pass. And Hashem says to Moshe, you're right, Yosef will be buried, but Yosef at least identified himself as a Jew throughout his time in Mitzrayim. He's constantly being referred to as Ivri, Hevi, Lanu Ish, Ivri Letzachek. His master's wife accuses him, but everyone knew him as a Jew. And he confesses, Gunov, Gunavti mi Beisa Ivrim, I was taken from the house of the Jews. And Moshe, you, as opposed to Yosef, allowed yourself only once, but still, you allowed yourself to be identified as an Ish Mitzri. When the daughters of Yisrael report to their father, they claim Ish Mitzri Hitzilanu, an Egyptian man saved us. And you didn't protest and say you're not an Ish Mitzri, you're an Ish Yehudi. So there are issues of identity that can't just be measured in terms of halachic observance and mitzvah and Talmud Torah. There's an identity of a Jew Hashem didn't tell Moshe that Yosef performed more mitzvos than you did or studied more Torah than you did. Hashem tells Moshe, Yosef ID'd himself as a Jew in ways that you didn't, despite all your Torah learning. He called himself a Jew. He wore his Jewish identity very proudly, very prominently. And that's more or less nascent, that's latent in Yosef's argument to his brothers and Yosef's assertion to his brothers. Listen to my Hebrew. I'm still that same person. Don't be fooled by my clothing. Don't be fooled by my position. Don't be fooled by the cultural mores surrounding you. Listen to language, and that language has preserved my identity. And remember, we spoke to one another a long time ago in Hebrew in a very different place. Go back to that time and live those experiences and allow that brotherhood, that fraternity, that solidarity that we felt before all this happened, let that transform you in the present. Language is extremely powerful. Chassidim speak, not just Chassidim, but in many yeshivos, especially in Eretz Yisrael, speak in Yiddish. Yiddish has, many people claim that Yiddish has an inherent value simply because so much Torah has been studied throughout the ages in Yiddish. Even if you don't believe that Yiddish has an inherent linguistic value, it certainly is a cultural buffer. It certainly creates a cultural buoyancy that if we just dress as we did in Europe and we speak as we did in Europe, it creates insularity and protection and safety. And communities that stress insularity, protection, and safety employ language as one of those checkpoints through which culture may not pass. Culture around you is not obviously speaking in Yiddish, but if we speak in Yiddish, then we can create cultural insularity. It's not something to take lightly. Obviously, for many people, it's Lashon HaKodesh, which is a language that spans millennia. It's not just a language that reflects 500 years of a golden period or 400 years of a golden era in Poland, but it's a language that is layered with the odyssey of the Jewish experience. And what makes Lashon HaKodesh so beautiful is precisely its layering, its striation. That there's biblical Hebrew, the Hebrew of Tanakh, and even in Tanakh, there's a difference between the Hebrew of the Torah and the Hebrew of the Nevi'im. Then there's Hebrew of the Amoraim, of the Tanaim, the Rabbinic Hebrew, and Hebrew throughout the ages. And now modern Hebrew, even though some of it it seems like a foreign implant, it's still a language that 6-7 million Jews or 6 million Jews are speaking in Eretz Israel and developing. Language is a dynamic process. It's an ongoing reality. It evolves. So Yosef is not just convincing his brothers that he is indeed the Yosef that he attests to be, but he's trying to return them to an earlier state of innocence, emotionally. And language is extremely powerful, extremely important, and every Jew has a responsibility. I believe to speak that second language as a Jew. You live in America, so you speak English. You live in Russia, you speak Russian. You live in Germany, you speak German. But there's a second language, because a Jew has to have a deeper commitment to Jewish identity, part of which is expressed in language. So whether that language is Yiddish or that language is Hebrew, I obviously feel more compelled by Hebrew, as is evident by my statements, but those are smaller differences, but the language is an important part of the evolving identity. Interestingly enough, this is how Yosef doesn't just convince his brothers, but reconnects with his brothers. When it comes to Yaakov, and Yosef realizes that in Yaakov's situation, language isn't sufficient, because Yaakov will not hear Yosef, Yaakov will just receive reports. So when it comes to Yaakov, Yosef employs not auditory experience, but visual experience, and he sends wagons. And Yaakov initially is skeptical, but for some reason, when he sees the wagons that Yosef sends, Vatechi Ruach Yaakov Avihim, his spirit is lifted. Chazal here also insert added material. They weren't just wagons. We would have thought, if we read the simple read, that somehow the wagons, maybe it was just an easier trip for Yaakov. It seems like it wasn't just pragmatic. It seems like V'tchi ruach Yaakov avichem. Something in Yaakov stirred by seeing wagons. Maybe he had secretly known all along that Yosef would achieve a position of honor and position of prestige, and seeing the wagons just reaffirmed that. This is my son who's accomplished, who's able to send wagons. V'tchi ruach Yaakov avichem. But Chazal say that Yosef sent the wagons as a trigger point, as a psychological trigger point. Almost when you hypnotize someone and you have that psychological trigger point, that will mean something more than its trivial trigger. That was the last Torah that Yosef and Yaakov had studied together before Yosef was sent to Shechem to find his brothers. And it has something to do with wagons. Rashi's interpretation is not the word wagon, but the phonetics of egla. Egla can mean a wagon, and it can also mean an egla rufa. It can mean a calf, which is beheaded when an innocent person is found dead in a forest. There's a burial ceremony accompanied by a calf, which is beheaded egla rufa. So somehow the syntax convinced Yaakov. He saw the wagon, and he said the word ayin gimel lamed hey can also mean a calf. And I remember I studied about the calf with my son Yosef. According to a different version in Chazal, they'd actually been studying about wagons. They were studying that one day the Mishkan would be built, and one day the princes of each tribe would donate golden plates and spice and animals. And one of the donations were, there were six wagons which were dedicated when the Beis HaMikdash, when the Mishkan was inaugurated. Two Nesiim contributed to one wagon. So if 12 Nesiim brought their gifts, then six wagons were dedicated entirely to carry the various vessels of the Mishkan. Either way, Yosef was trying to take Yaakov back to that point in time, that last point of interaction, that last memory, the last father-child memory. Yaakov, to a degree, excavated Yosef from his heart, as he has to. People have to move on. And Yosef, to a degree, emptied his heart of Yaakov, although he probably less so, because he knew the reality of his father. But Yaakov, just to live with himself, had to divorce himself from some of that suffering. Now Yosef isn't just convincing him again to know that it's him, but starting slowly to rebuild and resuscitate and replenish the relationship between father and son. And you go back to a very primal, earlier moment that you shared before the storm, before the controversy, before the suffering. And for Yaakov and Yosef, and for Yaakov, because Yosef's the one dispatching this message, for Yaakov it's really, or for Yosef delivering the message, it's really about the Torah we studied together. It's very formative to study Torah with another human being. It's even more formative to study it consistently, day in, day out, not just a chance moment of Torah. There's a continuity to Torah study. There's a systemic nature to Torah. And the more Torah you study, Torah is greater than the sum of its parts. Studying a lot of Torah together in a continuous fashion with the same people creates a dynamic that's larger than each particular topic of Torah that you're studying. And in particular, between father and child. To contextualize, to frame Torah within a broader relationship of father-son, mother-daughter, parent-children, grandchildren, etc., it creates a life of Torah. The Torah delivers a, there's a tradition of Torah. There's a Rav Soloveitchik, one of my rabbanim, became Rav Soloveitchik in part because he studied Torah with his father. And to create gedolim, you need to infuse Torah not just through schooling systems for so many reasons, partially practical, how much Torah at what time will be studied, but also the nature and texture of the Torah is different when it's not delivered in a classroom between a foreign person and his 30 students in grade 3, but when it's taught in the context of the hearth and the home. So when he speaks to his brothers, his trigger is language. When he speaks to his father, and he doesn't speak to his father, but when he communicates with his father, the trigger isn't really language. The trigger is Torah study. And there may be reasons that that particular wagon and the sugya which it referenced, the topic it referenced, had particular impact on Yaakov. If it was Egla Rufa, perhaps Yaakov's greatest fear descending to Egypt is, where will he be buried? And we see that fear rising to the surface in a very almost concerning fashion in Parshas Vayechi, forcing Yosef to swear that he'll bury him in Eretz Canaan. So of all Yaakov's fears descending to Mitzrayim, his greatest fear is, where will he be buried? So Yosef assures him, remember, you taught me the sugya of Egla Rufa, you taught me the sugya of burial responsibilities, and it's part of my system, it's part of my core values, don't worry, I'm taking responsibilities on me to bury you. If Yosef was discussing with Yaakov not Egla Rufa and burial duties, but he was discussing the wagons of the Nesiim, perhaps Yosef was assuring Yaakov that he sees himself as part of this larger saga of leading the Jewish people. This is leading to something. There will be a Mishkan one day. There will be a generation that leaves Mitzrayim and builds a Mishkan. They will donate those wagons. We studied about that 20 plus years ago. And even though now I'm asking you to descend to Mitzrayim and to immerse yourself in a foreign culture. And Yaakov is aware of the prophecies that this immersion is going to take a long time. And it's going to be followed by persecution and slavery. And there's got to be some ambivalence in Yaakov. He's also saying there is a time that I want you to think about that we studied about a long period ago, about the Mishkan and the wagons and the triumph and the ceremony and the majesty. And to be sure, Yaakov is aware of that as well. The Medrash says that Yaakov descends to Mitzrayim and on his way stops over in Beersheba and cuts down shittim wood. And he encases that shittim wood so that every generation will look at that shittim wood as they're being beaten into submission in Mitzrayim. They don't abdicate their redemptive vision that one day we'll leave and one day we'll build a Mishkan. It serves as a hedge or a wedge against the encroaching Egyptian persecution. So there are two fascinating moments in Parshas Vayigash of recovering lost fraternity. Yosef and his brothers, Yosef and his father, and the two trigger points are these formative experiences which we, and the earlier we introduce them into our lives and the more intensity we invest in them, the more formative they become. Language, how we speak, and I spoke about the language in which we speak, but it's also not just the language we choose to speak, but the way we train ourselves to speak and communication in general. And in Yaakov's case, the Torah that you study with someone, especially if that Torah has a larger framework, it's not just a shiur you heard, but a relationship that is built through Torah, it's an extremely, extremely... I know as a person, I've had this chus to be in the yeshiva world for close to 30 years, and even when I meet people I haven't seen in 10, 15, 20, sometimes in 25 years, but I remember learning with them back in the day in the yeshiva, going for smicha, sitting next to them, there's a bond, there's a trust, there's a comfort level that, of course, any common experience provides, but the deeper the experience, the more powerful the bond, and there's nothing as deep as Hashem's Torah. Shabbat Shalom.